The Oracle Network.
Warning. The following podcast contains mature content. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, and welcome to the jury room, where we dissect some of the most heinous, some of the most unthinkable, and some of the most monstrous crimes to ever scar the earth. From cannibalistic serial killers to decades-old unsolved mysteries, these stories are sinister enough to keep you up at night. When we left off the last episode, Houston co-eds Lori Lister and Melinda Aguilar had just sustained a vicious attack by a random stranger who was quickly identified as Carl Eugene Watts. Because of the heroic actions of Melinda, who jumped off a second-story balcony to get help, she and her roommate narrowly escaped becoming the next murder victims of one of the most prolific serial killers in America's history. From the moment that Melinda leaped from the second floor onto the grass below, everything happened very quickly. She smacked her head on the way down, but by some miracle, she wasn't knocked unconscious. Across the parking lot, a neighbor was enjoying a morning cup of coffee on their porch. With her hands still tightly bound behind her back, Melinda sprinted over to the neighbor and asked them to call for help. Police were immediately dispatched to the apartment complex. Meanwhile, back in Melinda and Lori's apartment, Watts went to Melinda's bedroom and found her door locked. Panicked that Melinda had gotten away, Watts tried to escape. Police arrived just as he was running down the stairs into the apartment courtyard. He bolted, and the officers pursued him on foot through the complex. As the chase commenced, Melinda, battered and bruised, waited for an ambulance in the parking lot. A woman named Patricia McDonald, who lived in an apartment beneath them, went upstairs to check on Lori. Patricia found Lori in the bathroom with her hands bound, with a wire coat hanger and a cloth gag in her mouth. Water from the faucet was still running in the bathtub, and Lori was completely submerged. Patricia said later that she thought Lori was dead when she pulled her out of the water because her skin was pale blue and she wasn't breathing. In the chaos of the moment, Patricia began frantically beating her fist on Lori's back until she choked up water, blood, and bile, clearing her airway so she could breathe. When Lori came to, she began struggling as if she were still fighting with someone. Had Patricia not gone upstairs, Lori would certainly be dead. Out in the parking lot, police escorted Melinda Aguilar within view of the open door of a squad car. They had cornered the man and arrested him as he was heading for the woods nearby. They asked if this was the man who had attacked her and Lori. Melinda took one look at the man and gave a resounding yes. Glaring at her from inside the cop car was Carl Eugene Watts. Houston police took Watts into custody for the assault on Aguilar and Lister, but detectives already knew they had a much bigger case on their hands. Remember, Watts' name was already known to Houston PD because Ann Arbor detective Paul Bunton had sent them his case file a year earlier when Watts moved from Michigan to Houston, Texas. Houston PD had surveilled Watts for several months in 1981, hoping to catch him in the act. But Watts didn't get so much as a parking ticket. Investigators backed off and moved on to other cases. Watts was then free to roam the streets of Houston, looking for new victims. Within hours of his arrest for trying to kill Aguilar and Lister, investigators went to the apartment Watts shared with his girlfriend, Sheila Williams. They asked to look around, but Williams refused to let them in without a warrant. They came back with one the next day, but Williams had moved out, the place was empty. Overnight, Williams hired two attorneys for Watts, Don Kaggins and Zanette Burney. Kaggins and Burney had both graduated from Thurgood Marshall School of Law at Texas State University in the 1970s, and they were now legal partners. Kaggins handled the civil rights cases, and Burney dealt with the criminal cases. According to Corey Mitchell, author of Evil Eyes, Burney initially thought Watts was just a normal guy who had a family and went to church on Sunday. But when he began telling her about the crimes he had committed, she realized she was dealing with someone truly violent. Mitchell quoted Burney saying, "He never threatened me. He was always quiet and polite to me, but he scared me more than anyone I have ever dealt with. There's something evil in the man." Houston police hit Watts with a major bluff. They convinced him they had a strong case against him in several Houston area murders. Watts believed this enough to ask his lawyers to pursue a plea deal. He would give them information on several murders in exchange for immunity from prosecution. He wanted to serve time for the burglary and assault on Aguilar and Lister, nothing else. In June of 1982, Coral Watts was sent to Rusk State Hospital by the state to determine if he was mentally sound enough to understand the charges against him and to stand trial. The doctors there ran a battery of tests. They administered an IQ test and scored him 68. But doctors attributed his low score to nerves. The state doctor concluded, quote, "Based on the above findings, it is my opinion there is no justification for a finding of incompetence to stand trial, in that he has sufficient ability to consult with his lawyer with a reasonable degree of rational understanding. He also has a rational as well as factual understanding of the proceedings against him." Unquote. The defense brought in their own psychiatrist to evaluate Watts, who determined the man was a paranoid schizophrenic with a pathological hatred for women. He recommended psychiatric intervention and intensive medical care, a recommendation likely engineered to grease the wheels for an insanity plea. However, the psychological evaluations of Watts turned out to be irrelevant. Houston prosecutor Ira Jones brokered a plea deal after months of negotiations between Watts' legal team and the city of Houston in exchange for a guilty plea to aggravated burglary and attempted murder of Aguilar and Lister, as well as detailed confessions to 13 murders and 6 assaults, Watts would receive immunity from prosecution. In 1982, Watts honored his end of the bargain. He began to sing like a canary. On August 9th, Coral Watts opened the floodgates to some of the most disturbing information imaginable. Over the course of 28 hours in the interrogation room, he detailed brutal murders and attacks he inflicted on women all around the Houston area. The crime spree spanned from September 1981 to May 1982. Here are some of the details. The murder of Linda Tilley helps illustrate the randomness of Watts' victims. In the early morning hours of September 5th, 1981, Watts noticed Linda Tilley driving west out of Houston and decided she would be his next victim. It turns out, Tilley was a student at the University of Texas in Austin. She studied art and had just entered her senior year when Watts spotted her driving down the road. The highway trip from Houston to Austin takes about 2.5 hours, and Watts followed her in his Pontiac Grand Prix the entire way until she pulled into the parking lot of her off-campus apartment. As she made her way to her apartment door, Watts rushed up and grabbed her from behind. She fought him as hard as she could. The struggle landed them both in the apartment swimming pool. Once in the water, Coral Watts overpowered her and forced her head beneath the water until she stopped moving. Watts left Tilly's body floating in the pool and drove back to Houston. Amazingly, no one in the apartment complex heard the struggle. Her body was found a few hours later, and authorities ruled it an accidental drowning. It wasn't until Watts' confession that Tilly's family and the Austin authorities learned the truth. Linda had been brutally murdered for no reason at all. A few minutes after midnight on September 12, 1982, University of Houston graduate student Elizabeth Montgomery stepped out of the apartment she shared with her fiancé to walk her two dogs. Coral Watts just happened to be driving down the street when he saw her. He quickly parked, came at her from the side. He told the police she didn't notice him until he had already grabbed her. With a large kitchen knife, he stabbed her once in the chest before she took off running toward her apartment. Elizabeth's fiancé heard her scream and rushed outside. He noticed she was holding her hand over a wound on her chest and managed to get her inside, only to watch her bleed out within seconds. Watts got back into his car and continued to drive around the night of September 12th until he came upon Susie Wolf pulling out of a supermarket parking lot. Watts followed her to her apartment a few blocks away. While she unloaded her groceries, Watts came up from behind her and threw her to the ground, wielding the same kitchen knife he had just used on Elizabeth Montgomery. Watts stabbed Susie in the chest and stomach multiple times. When Watts heard a man yelling nearby, he got up, got in his car, and drove away. Watts spotted Phyllis Tam jogging down the street in the early morning hours of January 4th, 1982. He followed her for a few blocks before he parked his car and ran over to her. Watts grabbed Tam with both hands and proceeded to strangle her with an elastic scarf she was wearing around her neck. When she was near death, Watts used Tam's scarf to hang her from a bush by the street to finish the job. When she was dead, Watts noticed she was wearing socks on her hands for warmth. He told police he took the socks and burned them to kill her spirit. When the detective asked him why she killed Tam, Watts responded, "'Cause she was evil." Margaret Fossey, better known as Meg, was a 25-year-old Mary architect student at Rice University. When she became the next unsuspecting victim of Carl Watts, Watts spotted Fossey when she was driving on January 17, 1982. Allegedly, Watts forced her off the road with his Grand Prix, and Fossey drove up on the curb and punctured both of her tires. When he walked up to the side of the vehicle, Fossey rolled her window down, and he punched her in the throat, crushing her larynx and killing her instantly. He took some architectural blueprints from her car and burned them. He told the police he figured it would kill the spirit. After Watts finished murdering Meg Fossey, he drove around looking for another victim. He ended up on the South Loop West Freeway when he saw Julie Sanchez pulled over on the side of the road fixing a flat tire. Watts walked up behind her and slit her throat twice. Amazingly, Julie Sanchez didn't die. Her husband showed up within minutes and drove her to a hospital where they were able to stop the bleeding. This happened at about 6:45 in the morning. While stalking another woman on January 29th, 1982, Watts noticed Alice Martell driving towards her apartment on the morning of January 29th, 1982. He followed her home, where he choked her on her doorstep and then stabbed her 5 times in the chest with an ice pick. Somehow, she survived the attack, Watts told the police he took her purse and burned it to kill her spirit. Here's an excerpt from the interrogation transcript of Carl Watts' confession about why he attacked Alice Martell, as recorded by Corey Mitchell in Evil Eyes.
And now, for a quick break.
I'm Paige, the host of Reverie True Crime. I tell stories of helpless victims, vicious killers, predators watching their prey before they strike, survivors, petty crimes, people we think we know who do the unthinkable, and the dangers that lurk not only in the dead of night, but in plain sight and the light of day. Every once in a while, I'll also tell stories of the frightening paranormal, elusive cryptids, haunted locations, and conspiracies that may be silly or thought-provoking. You can listen to Reverie True Crime wherever you're listening to this podcast. Feel free to follow me on Twitter at Reverie Crime Pod, Facebook, Instagram, and even Tumblr at Reverie True Crime. Remember, stay safe, be aware of your surroundings at all times, and take care.
Now, back to the show.
Detective Tom Ladd. All right, when you stabbed her, was she moving at any time then, or... Carl... I don't think so. She was motionless when you stabbed her with the ice pick? Did you feel like it was necessary to stab her? Did you think you had already killed her by choking her? Or did you think it was necessary to stab her to finish the job? I just stabbed her. No particular reason? Why did you stab her? That's what I had to do to her. Stab her. What purpose? Why did you pick this girl? I had just seen her. And the first time you had seen her, she was in her car driving? Yeah, she was coming across the light. All right, so in other words, you were going in one direction. She came to the intersection where you stopped at a red light? Uh-huh. Carl Watts passed Elena Samander, driving down the street in the early morning of February 7th, 1982. He instantly knew she was his next victim, so he turned around and followed her to the parking lot of an apartment complex. She noticed Watts as he approached her and attempted to flag down a passing vehicle for help. Watts grabbed her by the neck and choked her until she was dead. Then he stripped her, tied her shirt around her neck, and threw her in a nearby dumpster. Trash collectors discovered Elena's body the next morning. Carl Watts happened upon Edith Leddett coming home from a party on March 27, 1982. It happened to be the last day of her coursework to earn her medical degree. He stabbed her to death outside of her apartment. Within minutes of Leddett's attack, Watts attacked Glenda Kirby several streets over. His hands were slick with Edith's blood, so Glenda Kirby was able to escape the attack and survived. At 6 a.m. on April 15th, 1982, the neighbor of 22-year-old Yolinda Garcia stepped out to grab their morning paper and discovered her lifeless body laying face down in the front yard. She had been stabbed multiple times in the chest. Carl Watts told police he had noticed her getting off a bus and stabbed her to death as she approached her front door. Yolanda worked full-time for a jeweler and had a daughter. When police asked Watts why he killed Yolanda, he told them she had evil in her eyes. On May 23rd, 1982, hours before he attacked Melinda Aguilar and Lori Lister, Watts choked a cocktail waitress named Michelle Made outside of her apartment. He dragged her into her apartment and held her underwater in the bathtub until she was dead. Her body was found by her mother several hours later. She had just turned 20 years old. Once Watts was done confessing to murders in which the victims had been found, he directed investigators to the graves of women he had buried. Watts directed police to Suzanne Searless' body on August 10, 1982. She was on her way home from a party when Watts approached her and strangled her to death on April 21, 1982. He was sure she was dead by holding her head underwater in a flower pot. As he watched police dig up Suzanne's body, officials reported Watts couldn't have cared less. Prosecutor Ira Jones said, "We were there digging up a woman, and it didn't seem to bother him. He wanted a hamburger. So, when we were done, we took him out and bought him a hamburger." After Watts showed them the grave of Suzanne Searless, he took them to the location of Carrie Jefferson's body. Jefferson was a 32-year-old married postal worker with two children. Until Watts' confession, Jefferson was listed as a missing person. Watts murdered her on April 16, 1982, the day after he had stabbed Yolanda Garcia to death in her front yard. Police recovered Jefferson's body along the White Oak Bayou on August 11, 1982. Emily Lacua was a 14-year-old girl who authorities initially assumed to be a runaway when she disappeared on March 20, 1982. Watts told police where to find her body on August 12. They found her badly decomposed body in a drainage ditch in Brookshire, Texas. Watts also confessed to the murder of former Michigan journalist Janine Klein, as well as the attempted murder of Galveston woman Patty Johnson. Grosse Pointe, Michigan authorities agreed to include Klein's murder in the immunity plea bargain so they could close the case. Patty Johnson's attack, which had occurred on January 30th, 1982, resulted in the wrongful conviction of another man. Only after Watts' confession was the conviction overturned. One of the interviewing detectives remembered asking Watts, "I don't have enough fingers and toes to count the number of your victims, do I?" Watts reportedly looked around the room and said, "There aren't enough finger and toes in this room." There were four detectives in the room, which led them to believe Watts had over 80 victims. Detectives from all over the country converged upon Houston to question Carl Watts about their cold cases. There was just one caveat. Watts wasn't talking unless he was guaranteed immunity. For Detective Paul Bunton of Ann Arbor, Michigan, who had been trying to catch Watts for years, immunity was not an option. Bunton told Cold Case Files that he had a meeting with his prosecutor, and they decided, quote, "You don't give immunity to a murderer. You just don't do that," unquote. Paul Bunton and the Ann Arbor officials were not alone in their opinions about offering immunity to murderers. Many of the Houston victims' families claimed prosecutors had not discussed the plea bargain with them prior to making a deal with Watts, and they were rightfully furious. Local citizens were outraged. The county prosecutors and officials received death threats. At Watts' sentencing hearing, prosecuting attorney Ira Jones wore a bulletproof vest, and the judge had the courtroom cleared and sniffed by bomb dogs before proceeding. During the hearing, the court heard testimony from several people involved in the aftermath of Watts' attack on Lori Lister and Melinda Aguilar. This included Lori Lister's upstairs neighbor, Patricia McDonald, the investigating detective, Jim Ladd, and the medical examiner. Despite numerous objections from Watts' attorney, the court listened as these witnesses described his clear intent to kill these women, including Watts' use of the bathwater as a deadly weapon. The goal of this legal show was to have the testimony included in the documentation that would later be sent to Watts' parole hearings. unbelievable. As a result of the plea deal, the confessed serial killer, Carl Eugene Watts, would be eligible for parole beginning in the early 1990s. The preceding judge expressed disdain over the plea agreement, but made it plain his hands were tied by the law. He sentenced Watts to the maximum amount of jail time allowed, 60 years in prison. On September 24th, 1982, Watts began serving his 60-year term in a Texas prison. But that's not where his story ends. The plea deal prosecutors cut with him would come back to haunt them, mostly thanks to Texas mandatory release law. Beginning in 1977, as an answer to overcrowding in prisons, Texas began releasing inmates before they had served their entire sentence. According to a paper published by the Texas House of Representatives in 1997, there are three ways a felon can be released from prison. 1. By serving all of their sentence. 2. By being released on parole. 3. Or by being released through a special program called mandatory supervision, sometimes called mandatory release. The paper outlines the mandatory supervision law in the following terms. Quote, the mandatory supervision law requires persons to be released with their calendar time served plus good conduct time equals the length of their sentence. Felons who commit certain violent offenses are not eligible for release on mandatory supervision. But for most inmates who qualify for the program, mandatory supervision release is automatic. Unquote. You might be asking, what is good conduct time? Good conduct time is calculated based on your prisoner status and whether or not you are considered a model inmate. The standard calculation for every 30 days of good conduct, you receive 20 days of time served. In other words, 30 days of good conduct equals 50 days of time served of your sentence. That can go up to 30 days of good conduct time, or go down to 10. Essentially, if you behave yourself in prison and you haven't been convicted of a violent crime, you can potentially cut your prison time in half. Violent offenders are not eligible for the early release program. Watts had been sentenced to 60 years in prison for the crime of burglary with the intent to commit murder. 60 years was the maximum penalty allowed under the law. But in order to categorize Watts as a violent offender, prosecutors were supposed to provide Watts with a notice about what they were considering the deadly weapon in the case. When Watts attacked Lori Lister, he assaulted her with her hands and then dragged her into her apartment bathroom with the intent of drowning her in the bathtub. As a result of the unusual choice of murder weapon, prosecutors were required to include this piece of information in the indictment, but they didn't do this. They waited until the sentencing hearing to establish the bathwater as a deadly weapon, which was incorrect. Watts figured this out on his own. He had become a regular bookworm in the prison library and had gained an impressive understanding of the law. He appealed, and in 1989, his conviction was reduced to burglary. And with that, he was officially considered a non-violent offender. This made him eligible to collect good conduct time to reduce his sentence, and Watts was issued a mandatory release date for April 2006. Controversial even in its day, the Texas mandatory release law has been amended several times, most recently in the mid-1990s. To give the parole board veto power over the mandatory release of an inmate. The changes to the law had a lot to do with Carl Watts specifically. Harriet Seamander, the mother of Elena Seamander, whom Watts murdered in 1982, campaigned for years alongside victims' rights activist Andy Kahn to have the Texas law altered to prevent Carl Watts' premature release. There was only one problem. These changes were not retroactive, meaning Carl Watts had been sentenced prior to 1995. The parole board had no veto power over his release. Their veto power only extended to inmates sentenced after 1995. Carl Watts was going to be released from prison in April of 2006, and there wasn't anything anyone could do about it. Or was there? Andy Kahn, Harriet Seamander, and many other of Carl Watts' victims' family spent countless hours trying to get the details of his crimes in front of a broader audience. One of the ways they did this was by organizing a memorial service called a Call to Action in 2002. Hundreds of people showed up to hear the grief-stricken recollections of mothers, fathers, husbands, partners, children, and friends as they spoke of their loved ones who had been murdered by Carl Watts more than 20 years ago.
And now, for a quick break.
Hey there, Rainbow Warriors. I'm CJ, host of Beyond the Rainbow, True Crimes of the LGBT. My episodes focus on crimes committed by and against the LGBTQ community. I've covered cases you probably have heard of, such as Matthew Shepard, Brandon Tina, and the Orlando Pulse nightclub massacre, as well as some lesser-known cases like the murder of Ray Hainish, the Australian Gay Beat murders, and the suspicious disappearance of Lisa Lynn Stone. I cover cases brought to me by listeners like Penny Brummer, who I believe was wrongfully convicted, taboo cases such as lesbian corrective rape and murder in South Africa, and Pray the Gay Away camps. I discuss gay serial killers, women who pretend to be men to hook up with other women, and trans murders. I'm opinionated and uncensored. I know I'm not everyone's cup of tea, but surely I'm someone shot at tequila. No matter what your gender or orientation in life might be, please join me as I tackle rainbow crimes in search of unicorn justice. Remember, it's not a crime to be gay. Unless you're a murderer.
Now, back to the show.
The event was televised and received national attention. Not to mention, put pressure on law enforcement agencies. Houston police began to look at the case of Emily Lacua and the 14-year-old victim Watts had confessed to back in 1982. As it turned out, Lacua's murder occurred outside of the jurisdiction of the plea agreement. The problem was, police still had absolutely no physical evidence tying Watts to the murder. It seemed like all hope was lost for keeping Watts in jail in Texas. That faulty plea agreement from so many years ago was going to put a serial killer back onto the streets, and he would most certainly kill again. Lucky for the families of Watts' victims and countless other women who might have become his victims, a prosecutor in Michigan named Donna Pendergast wasn't going to let him be released without a fight. Ann Arbor police and prosecutors who refused to offer Watts immunity from prosecution in exchange for confessions 20 years prior left Michigan free to prosecute him if they could find the evidence. So, they opened a statewide investigation into cold cases that matched the MO of Carl Watts. Michigan Attorney General Mike Cox made a plea for anyone to come forward with information about cases related to Carl Watts. In December 1979, a man from Ferndale, Michigan, witnessed the murder of Helen Dutcher while sitting on his apartment balcony looking out over the parking lot. He called police immediately and gave a description of the perpetrator and his vehicle. Nothing came of it. Foy saw Watts on the news during the criminal proceedings surrounding his plea agreement and sentencing. He called police again, but they dismissed him. They told him to let it go because Watts was already getting 60 years for the Houston assaults. After seeing Mike Cox on TV, Foy called the Attorney General's office and told them he had witnessed a Watts murder back in 1979. Once they vetted Foy and deemed him credible, Michigan wasted no time petitioning the state of Texas to have Carl Watts extradited to stand trial for the 1979 murder of Helen Dutcher. At the time, Watts was undergoing treatment for prostate cancer, but for whatever reason, decided not to fight the extradition. Watts was taken to Michigan on April 22, 2004. On November 7, 2004, prosecutor Donna Pendergast delivered her opening arguments in the case of Helen Dutcher. Corey Mitchell reprinted this riveting passage from Pendergast's statement. Quote, "The defendant's pattern and scheme was to target women who were alone, and Helen Dutcher fit the defendant's plan, just like the 13 other women he admitted to killing. What is known from the physical evidence at the scene is that the defendant first had contact with and first cut Helen out in front of the establishment because blood belonging to Helen was found in the snow in front of the building. After Helen was first cut, she was either chased or, more likely, once you know the specifics of the defendant's pattern, forced to the alley end of that same service drive, the same alley that abuts Mr. Foy's yard, same spot where Helen Dutcher would ultimately die, just inside the entrance. The alley entrance to that service drive, after being stabbed 12 times in the neck, the chest, and the back, but it wouldn't happen without a witness. Joseph Foy. At the end of this trial, when you leave this courtroom, you will leave it a changed person because you will have an understanding that evil can wear a human face. And you will have looked square into the face of evil. You will have the luxury of doing that from the jury box. Helen Dutcher had no such luxury. She looked at evil up close on December 1st, 1979, unquote. Joseph Foy was their star witness, and Judge Richard Kuhn allowed all of Watts' 1982 confession into evidence to establish a pattern of behavior. Pendergast called three of Watts' survivors to testify as well, including Lori Lister, Melinda Aguilar, and Julie Sanchez. The trial was emotional. In reality, the Michigan prosecutors didn't have much physical evidence related to the actual murder of Helen Dutcher. What they did have were very competent and credible witnesses who had faced Watts and lived to tell the tale. Julie Sanchez offered painfully passionate testimony on the witness stand. Using the prosecutor as a model, she demonstrated how Watts slit her throat twice before leaving her for dead on the ground beside the highway. She testified that before he got back into his car, Watts turned around and laughed at her as she choked on her own blood. Melinda Aguilar and Lori Lister each calmly recounted the worst day of their lives, just as they had done back in 1982, to send Watts to jail in the first place. Joseph Foy told the story he had waited to tell for 25 years and remained unrattled even as Watts' defense attorney hammered him on the stand. Without any doubt in his voice, Foy repeated over and over again that he saw a man slashed at a woman in the parking lot, and when the man walked past him, they locked eyes. Foy calmly and repeatedly identified Carl Watts as the man who killed Helen Dutcher in 1979. Watts' defense attorney, Ron Kaplowitz, knew he had an uphill battle to an acquittal. He even told the jury, "You are going to hate this man." But he tried to get the jury to focus on the fact that the only evidence the state had in this particular murder case was a 25-year-old eyewitness. Kaplowitz was correct. The jury did hate Watts. Listening to days of survivor testimony, as well as transcripts from Watts' Houston murder confession, was too much for Kaplowitz to argue against. On November 17, 2004, after only 3 hours of deliberation, the jury delivered a verdict of guilty for Carl Watts. During Watts' sentencing on December 7th, he did address the court in regard to the guilty verdict. Watts told the judge that he did not kill Helen Dutcher and insisted that if he had, he would have confessed to it. Perhaps this is true, but he made it clear in 1982 that he wouldn't confess to any murders without the promise of immunity, so that statement doesn't hold water. Judge Richard Kahn expressed veiled rage over his inability to sentence the defendant to death. Quote, "This case cries out for the death penalty. No, it screams for the death penalty, but Michigan does not allow it," unquote. Instead, Kahn sentenced Watts to life in prison without the possibility of parole, and with that, everyone in the courtroom, aside from Carl Watts, breathed a sigh of relief, and the hits just kept coming for Watts. The same day Watts received his guilty verdict, the DA in Kalamazoo, Michigan, announced they were bringing charges against him for the 1974 murder of 19-year-old college student Gloria Steele. Less than 3 years later, Watts stood trial for Steele's murder and received a second life sentence, but it didn't matter. On September 21st, 2007, at the age of 53, Carl Eugene Watts died of prostate cancer while serving his prison sentence. If his implied victim count over 80 victims is to be believed, Carl Eugene Watts is the most prolific serial killer in the United States history. There was no rhyme or reason behind how he selected his victims. They were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. As a result, their lives were snuffed out by a monster. Not only that, but the legal system failed the victims so spectacularly that many of their family members had to devote decades of their lives to push for true justice to be served. This case is probably the most difficult one I have ever had to research. The randomness and the brutality behind Watts' attacks haunt me. This man was not unknown to the police. He just outsmarted them for several years. As a result, dozens of young women were brutally murdered. Please, join me in a moment of silence for what could possibly be 80 plus victims. Thanks for listening, and remember, you never know what's lurking in the shadows, lingering around the corner, walking past your house at night. So watch out, stay safe, and keep listening. This has been The Jury Room.